Veronica Hubany, who's at Durham, Alex Maloney, a postdoc at Stanford, and Mukund Rangamani, who's also at Durham. These are some very selected list of references that will just be enough to get you into the literature, should you choose after this talk to do so. And there are lots more, of course, and I can help supply them, or by tracking forward and backward in the citations databases, you can probably find most of the stuff that's relevant. Okay, well, despite my negative remarks, I think all of us will agree, and if you don't, you should, that inflation is one of the most fascinating phenomena in gravitational physics. Let me just remind you of a few of its remarkable features. This phenomenon happens when you take space and you fill it up with some stuff that acts like a positive cosmological constant. The typical stuff we talk about is you have some scalar field. Here's some V of phi. Here's phi. And you imagine that the scalar field lives in this metastable state at energy greater than zero. And so it creates positive energy density. And then Einstein's equations react to that positive energy density in this remarkable way. The scale factor in some FRW kind of universe grows exponentially with time. And the rate of growth, h, is related to the square root of lambda times some Planck's constant, Newton's constant. This is a very impressive rate of growth. You start with a little patch of universe in one e-folding, which is quite microscopic. The size, well, roughly doubles, and then it doubles again, and it doubles again. I guess I'm drawing on a logarithmic scale, I guess, but you get the idea. And this incredibly rapid growth of space-time just has all kinds of consequences. I'm sure you've been told the sort of phenomenological good things about this. It dilutes any heavy remnant particles, like monopoles, that are around in the very early universe. It smooths out remnant curvature, makes the universe almost flat. And especially impressive is that this exponential expansion sets up, as we'll talk about in a minute, a de Sitter space that has quantum kind of Hawking radiation, de Sitter radiation in it, that gets translated into little ripples in space-time. And these ripples seem like they are the seeds for structure formation. And all the properties that I've observed about these ripples are consistent with inflation, and that's really remarkable. They're not consistent with anything else we know about. So it seems likely, although it's not proven, that something like this remarkable explosion happened in the very early universe. But as soon as you start looking at it, you find out how puzzling it is. I guess the first thing that's puzzled me is, where did all this space come from? Where do all these degrees of freedom come from? You start with a little space. A microsecond later, you got, you know, 10 to the 30th light years of space. How did that happen? There, you know, we usually think of degrees of freedom, like one per lattice point in a field theory. All of a sudden, the number of lattice points has grown by some unimaginably large factor. Now, this is sort of, in some sense, an old problem. We're used to thinking about expanding universes ever since the, I guess, the first third of the 20th century. But this kind of expansion makes the problem really immediate. Okay, power law expansion, well, you can put that away for a while. Exponential expansion, you can't ignore. So this is just one question it raises. There are all kinds of other questions that especially when you think about the exit. How does space-time stop inflating? In the original proposals for inflation, often called old inflation by Guth, where you have a setup like this, every now and then, you tunnel by some bubble out of the inflating region. And so if this is the inflating part of space, every now and then, you form a bubble of, let's say, flat space with energy equals zero. And then here'd be another flat space bubble, and so on. But what was taken to be a serious problem by Guth and his collaborators is now taken to be a wonderful feature by some of my colleagues at Stanford. That this uncolored part of space is expanding so fast that these bubbles never connect. So once you start inflation, even though it's in some sense metastable, it never stops. So call this eternal inflation. It's eternal, called eternal inflation because it never stops. Well, there are other types of inflation that have been discussed where a potential looks more like this, so-called slow roll models, where you start here and the scalar field rolls down. And you think when you get to the bottom, things will stop. Here, a slightly more sophisticated analysis, due to Linde, is that because this field is not strictly classical, it has quantum fluctuations. Every now and then when classically the field goes down, a quantum fluctuation will kick you back up. And for reasonable values of parameters, again, inflation will never stop. You think classically you're going to roll down, but the quantum stuff kicks you back up, and you're just always suspended above the bottom. This is often referred to as something like eternal chaotic inflation, which is the first kind of, one of the first kinds of this stuff. And the space-time there doesn't have this sort of rather regular bubbles and expanding space. It's some kind of very weird fractal thing where you have expanding regions tapering into non-expanding regions. And it seems, as far as we can tell, that gravity really does this. It just seems so wild that it's hard to understand. But there are more and more indications from experiment that some form of this does happen. And so the need to understand it is more and more pressing. Now, clearly, you know, one thing we'd like to do is understand inflation in the context of a relatively well understood theory of gravity, like string theory. And it would be nice to be able to embed the structure, which really is understood in terms of general relativity plus maybe scalar field theory, in a more complete framework that includes both gravity and matter, and is quantum mechanically consistent. Can people copy this down if you're going to copy? No, it's going to be on the website, isn't it? So. But understanding inflation in string theory has proven to be extremely difficult. Even until relatively recently, building a low energy effective field theory of a certain string background that looked like this with something over here, people didn't know how to do it. And it was substantial progress when KK, L, and T built using a rather complicated structure of flux vacua, anti-D3 brains, and so on, to be able to find a metastable minima like that in an otherwise sensible string theory. Their construction was somewhat uncontrolled, but it's interesting that over the few years since this was done, that subsequent developments, at least to my eye, seem to be allowing more and more controlled constructions. And I think now the evidence that such a thing exists is very good. But this is only the first bit. Okay, so it seems that string theory might be able to fall into one of these things. But what do these things really mean in terms of quantum gravity? Well, people have obviously thought about trying to understand these metastable minima in terms of fancy versions of quantum gravity. The space that's exponentially expanding is called De Sitter space. So a lot of effort has gone into understanding the quantum theory of De Sitter space. You might say, well, it's almost like anti-De Sitter space without the anti. It should be possible to understand. But it's really a lot different and a lot harder, and for a number of reasons. Well, if we draw a Penrose diagram of De Sitter space, it's a square, and some Schwarzschild coordinate here is r equals 0, r equals 0, r equals infinity. These are horizons The first thing is there's no spatial boundary at infinity like there is in ADS CFT. These spatial or time-like boundaries, these time-like boundaries are kind of in the middle of space. They're a finite difference, distance from the bifurcation point. This is like an origin of polar coordinates. The only infinities are infinitely forward in time and infinitely backward in time. This is the place where all that infinite, that exponential volume is accumulating up here. So, you know, physicists sort of, once they learn one trick, they try to do it over and over. One thing we might try to do is put some degrees of freedom on some boundary and make like an ADS CFT correspondence. The only real alternative here is to put degrees of freedom at future infinity and past infinity. This idea is called DS CFT. And in some sense, it makes sense, but we don't really know what degrees of freedom to put here, and so it's not become operational. Other ideas people have had are to think about the observer moving along this line. The region that this observer can be affected by and can affect is called a static patch, is the thing inside that pink triangle. And various holographic ideas suggest that you should be able to put degrees of freedom on some so-called stretched horizon inside this horizon and describe the physics that this static observer is seeing. This is sometimes referred to as the hot tin can model. This observer sees a hot tin can corresponding to the horizons. Unfortunately, we don't know what those degrees of freedom should be. This isn't a locally anti-de Sitter region. So therefore, the boundary theory will not be locally conformal. Therefore, it will not be a local field theory. Any boundary description that's a local field theory at short distances will look conformal. And so the space will have to look like locally anti-de Sitter space. So it'll be something else, some quantum system. We don't know what kind. The only thing we have a reasonable idea about is what its number of degrees of freedom should have. The entropy of de Sitter space, which is determined by the size of the spheres along this horizon, again, it's the area of the horizon over 4G, as it always is. And that goes like the radius of de Sitter space, I'll call it R sub D, raised to the right power for the sphere. I guess that's D, where D is space-time minus 3. Is that right? No, 2 probably. Yeah. These horizons give off Hawking radiation, as horizons typically do. That's the radiation that causes these wiggles that seed all the structure in the universe, if this theory is right. So these horizons are of some importance to all of us. All right, so people have thought a lot about this, but we don't have any real operational device. We don't have a Hamiltonian, the analog of four-dimensional super Yang Mills, or the analog of matrix theory quantum mechanics, or the analog of the two-dimensional string theories with matrix integrals, that really lets us handle the de Sitter space and will let us get into some of these questions. I should mention that one interesting proposal that people have made is that there's a certain number of degrees of freedom describing the static patch. There are a whole bunch of other regions that are kind of symmetric to it in here. Maybe they are all related by a gauge symmetry. And so even though you have this effectively infinite number amount of space, the number of degrees of freedom you need to understand de Sitter space is this finite entropy. That's one of the very interesting conjectures you'd like to examine. All right. Well, one of the difficulties in understanding de Sitter space is that, at least let's say for the static patch observer, there are no good places at infinity to define an S matrix. There were in ADS CFT, there are in flat space. Here they're not. The only asymptotics are this future infinity and past infinity. You can't go out far in space. So you don't know what a S matrix is. And string theory is always really bad, as I told you last time, at answering such questions. This is, if we had this magical local description that I pined for last time, we would be able to address this question rather well. We just take a local description of string theory and put it in the static patch and say, what does it do? Well, so maybe we can follow the provisional ideas that we used last time and try to embed this intrinsically kind of local phenomenon into a system where we can define asymptotic S matrix observables. So concretely, maybe we can make a little bubble in a finite region of space of this metastable phase. So here's space, and we make a little bubble of the inflating phase. I'll call it I, for inflating. And then let's look at it from far away and say, well, what's happening? We can make S matrix measurements on this inflating bubble. Well, if this were doable, you would have heard about it already. Okay. There are a lot of problems with it. The first problem is that this is a chunk of positive energy. If you're far away and you see a chunk of positive energy, like all the mass in the center of our galaxy, what it likes to do is to fall together and make black holes. What this bubble is going to do, according to an outside observer, is it's going to form a black hole. So the outside observer is going to say, gee, that's interesting. You put a bunch of energy together and you formed a black hole. Okay. On the other hand, if you go behind the horizon, it's possible that this region is going to remember, hey, I'm in a positive energy state. I'm going to start inflating. And so it's possible, and this is what we're going to talk about quite a bit, that you can arrange a situation that an external observer sees a black hole, but if you could observe behind the horizon, you would see an inflating region. Well, and as we talked about yesterday, we have techniques that in certain situations allow us to see things behind the horizon, especially if, let's say, the profile of this bubble were analytic and so on. And so we might be able to, as asymptotic observers, use these delicate techniques and see some aspect of this inflating region behind the horizon. Well, this idea certainly isn't new to us. In fact, 15 years or so more. Yeah, more than 15 years ago, Alan Guth and his collaborators thought about doing something like this, and they called it making a universe in a laboratory. You take some accelerator, or I don't know what, a laser or some scalar field device, and you assemble a bunch of energy in a region, and then you would make a little bubble that inflated exponentially. It would be like a little baby universe. And I don't know if they were exhilarated about this prospect or terrified that this might happen. But they rapidly convinced themselves that you couldn't do this. And the reason that you can't do it is that if you have one of these inflating regions, the size of, let's say, spheres, suppose you're in this kind of setup where you have a sphere going along that's suppressed on this diagram, the sphere grows exponentially with time, because all scales are growing exponentially with time. If you turn that backwards, you find spheres that are shrinking rapidly in time. And there are basic theorems in general relativity that if you have spheres like that are shrinking in time, you can't stop them. They just keep shrinking to zero and turn into singularities. Okay, well, it's either the reverse, the time reverse, or the time forward version of a standard singularity theorem. So if you're trying to do this at some earlier time, and it has to be like a microscopic time, you would have found some black hole singularity. And they quite sensibly said, well, any laboratory that we're living in has not experienced a black hole singularity lately, so we're not going to be able to do this. But here we are better equipped than they are. Okay. we, and especially and first Trodden and his collaborators, realized that an ADS CFT we spend a lot of time, in fact, I think I bored you yesterday, talking about these so-called eternal black holes that have a singularity in the future, but they also have a singularity in the past, a white hole. And this is just what the doctor ordered in order to start an inflationary process. And although I agree with Guth and his collaborators that this would be hard to make in a laboratory, we can make it in a gauge theory, which would allow us to theoretically study this kind of universe. So instead of a universe in a laboratory, maybe a universe in a computer would be the best way to describe it. And so that's what we're going to talk about, is ways of sort of, if you will, embedding a bubble in this kind of eternal black hole and seeing inflation. And if we could do that, we might be able to use some of the ideas about seeing behind the horizon that I talked about yesterday to see this inflating region. And then even more optimistically, although we really haven't gotten that far, answer some of these questions about the strangeness of inflation. So that's the idea, to do that. Okay. Are there any questions about this proposal? Okay. It's only going to get weirder, so. So let's first try to find classical solutions of GR plus scalar field that look like these drops of inflation. And so we'll assume, oh, I forgot an important point here. We're going to work in this ADS CFT context. Why should we be allowed to do this? Well, it turns out that typically in these landscape constructions in string theory, you typically make many anti-de Sitter supersymmetric minima, as well as these de Sitter metastable minima, which of course are not supersymmetric. And over here, you can make all kinds of other things. But for now, let's just focus on these two. If you put the whole theory in this ADS minima, it's ADS. So it should have a boundary description that is a CFT. But because you can describe like local excursions of the field in the CFT, you should be able to describe local bubbles of this in this CFT. So there should be a description in the CFT corresponding to these various ADS SUSY minima that will describe inflation. So the existence of these landscape type arrays of minima give us some hope that you will actually be able to find an ADS CFT dual that will contain the physics of a de Sitter metastable minimum. Just as a side, let me mention that, you know, these, as you know, these constructions contain, you know, 10 to the few hundred ADS supersymmetric minima. So these predict that there will be 10 to the few hundred conformal field theories running around. It's a very interesting question to find these conformal field theories. And not just for this reason, of course, but for lots of reasons. So we will assume, without further discussion, that there is some kind of string theory described at some level by this effective potential, that it's described by a conformal field theory in this minimum. And then now we will use analysis in the bulk of classical gravity to see how these minima are linked together. So the first thing we'll do is we'll heat up this minimum to make an ADS Schwarzschild black hole. Let's say it looks like this. Then we will modify the interior region to assume we have some of this metastable minima, set a scalar field with this value, and then somewhere we'll let it have this value. Now, typically, between these two values, there'll be some profile. If this is minima 1 and this is minima 2 and this is 1 and this is 2, there'll be some domain wall. So you'll have some scalar field here in minima 1, and it'll cross a domain wall and be in minima 2, which is ADS out at infinity. The only practical way to construct such solutions is to assume that this domain wall is thin on the length scales of the ADS scale, the De Sitter scale, the black hole horizon scale, all relevant scales. It can be large compared to the Planck length, but all classical scales. And so then you can approximate this domain wall by an infinitely thin line, and you study matching conditions across that line. So typically, you might have a domain wall. I should do some colored chalk. That's a domain wall. And on the left-hand side, you replace this ADS Schwarzschild black hole with the De Sitter space. So you have something that looks like and this is the De Sitter R equals 0 boundary here. So that's what the kind of geometry that we'd like to construct is. Now, the basic things you need is you need to build some matching conditions that determine the shape of this trajectory. Now, these matching conditions, this is a well-studied problem in general relativity. They're often referred to as the Israel matching conditions. And if we have a coordinate of the domain wall, let me call that R matching of proper time tau along the domain wall. And let me describe these metrics. The metric on the right, the ADS Schwarzschild black hole, let's describe them both in terms of what I would call Schwarzschild form that we used yesterday. And we'll suppress the angular variables. The warp factor for the De Sitter space, F De Sitter of R equals R De Sitter squared minus R squared. And F, let's say we're in three dimensions, so this is the BTZ black hole. F black hole of R equals R squared minus the horizon size squared. So those are the two metrics, and we want to join them. Now, I guess I won't write down the matching condition. You get a rather simple differential equation in terms of, for the function R of tau, in terms of these two Fs. And you can cast it in the form, again, of an effective mechanics problem, as we did yesterday. R dot squared matching plus some effective potential of R matching equals 0. And the effective potential as a function of R is some kind of single hump smooth function like that. And then this trajectory of this domain wall, singularities correspond to R equals 0. The size of a sphere shrinks to 0. Here R gets bigger and then gets smaller. So it's some trajectory that kind of looks like coming out, and then coming back in. This is R equals 0. So this is a perfectly good, as far as we can tell, solution matching De Sitter space onto the external of the ADS Schwarzschild black hole. Several comments. First of all, this De Sitter space doesn't last very long. It starts off at kind of zero size, the droplet. Here it starts off at kind of maximum size, and then it rapidly shrinks to zero. And this is the time reverse. This happens in a de Sitter time, the time of the characteristic scale of de Sitter space. So this is a little piece of de Sitter space that rapidly crunches. Second, what an external observer observes on this time slice, they say, oh, this is a big chunk of energy. But it's collapsing, and it forms a black hole. I see this black hole horizon. So from the external observer, it's the most mundane thing possible. It's a bunch of energy collapsing into a black hole, plus it's time reverse. And this would be easily detectable to boundary correlator probes that could scatter off it and so on. Yet, if you look carefully behind the horizon, you'd find a de Sitter region for a little while. That would be the first inkling of some piece of inflation. Now, it's not the only thing that really distinguishes inflation is this infinite period. So this is just kind of a precursor, if you will. OK, well, now let's imagine changing the initial data a little bit. So the initial data you might specify on this line, it's roughly how big a bubble of the scalar field you have. So let's say this is the first one. I think I need my colored chalk here. I need a tool belt, I think, to carry this stuff around. Oh, I see. The problem is there's no tray on the chalkboard. That's the issue. OK, well, if you imagine making the bubble a little bigger, it makes the black hole horizons a little bigger, because there's more energy. So it's easier to cover up this de Sitter space. And so the next thing you might draw qualitatively, I'll do it in several steps. Here's the black hole metric. Here's the domain wall. Notice that this line is all the way behind these horizons now. It corresponds on this effective potential to a trajectory like this. It starts at r equals 0, it bounces back. There's nothing qualitatively different. And then, of course, after you draw this line, what you do is you erase this, and you draw this. And although it's not clear in a Penrose diagram, this is a bigger hunk of de Sitter space than it was here. Now, you might say, what's going on here? You can't tell the difference between this region and a pure black hole anymore. But remember, we're concentrating on analytic data. So this domain wall has some spread to it. So there's some exponential tails that leak out into this region that by analyticity provide enough information to construct this geometry. So the signature outside the black hole now of this inflating process are these exponentially small tails. And that's a pretty weak signature, but it is a signature. And I'm afraid that's what we're forced to deal with in this puzzling behind the horizon business. In any event, going from here to here, we don't see anything qualitatively different. It's a small change in initial data. We don't see why you shouldn't be able to do this in the CFT if it exists. All right, well, you can keep making the size of the droplet bigger and bigger. The next thing that happens qualitatively, so again, we'll go through this construction process. There's an ADS-Schwarzschild black hole. Let's increase kind of the energy or bring the potential down so that your trajectory corresponds to just living on the top of the hill and not changing in tau. Not surprisingly, this is called the static domain wall. So R doesn't change in proper time. So the trajectory of the domain wall is an R equals constant trajectory in this space. That's what R equals constant trajectory looks like. And notice that it meets the ends, the corners of this diagram. So again, you then join on de Sitter space to it. And this is now getting slightly more interesting. Again, we don't see anything that stops you from moving across this line. That might be one of our confusions that we're operating under, however. This R sits on the top of the thing for every tau, for infinite amounts of tau. So this domain wall lives for infinite amounts of time. So what this corresponds to is a piece of De Sitter space. It's not all of De Sitter space. It's a fraction of the static patch here. In this region, it looks like this. That lives for all the time in De Sitter space, but doesn't cover the full static patch. Doesn't have light-like boundaries, so it can't cover all the static patch. And so it's a piece of this hot tin can, maybe about half of it, evolving in time forever. So you have some region of De Sitter space evolving for infinite time. It seems like you've captured some aspects of De Sitter space. Well, yes, you have, but not a lot of the most interesting ones. Okay. First of all, you don't have the amount of space growing infinitely. The amount of space stays finite. Secondly, if you ask what happens to the De Sitter radiation, what does the static observer see here? Well, the De Sitter horizon that radiates De Sitter radiation has been replaced by the black hole horizon, which radiates black hole radiation, which is much hotter. And so, in fact, there is black hole radiation streaming through this domain wall, heating up the De Sitter space. It's not enough to cause back reaction at small g squared. And so an observer here sees a funny De Sitter space. He thinks, I'm living in De Sitter space, but it is hot in here. The horizons are heated up by this external lamp that if he looks vaguely through the domain wall, he says, wow, there's a hot region out there. And so you don't directly see the De Sitter fluctuations. But this is an example, though, where you've made a rather drastic change in the geometry. The geometry is not collapsing back to pure ADS Schwarzschild in a short time. Okay, but so far, I would say that things are sensible and hence boring. So I guess I'm moving to the left here. So. Yes. The first two cases correspond to qualitatively the same trajectory. They both look like this. One is at a little different place than the other. There's a funny minus sign that moves you from this horizon to that I haven't explained. Okay, but that's the reason that there's two. Yes. It doesn't matter too much. Yeah, well, we postulate something and we verify that things are not too dependent on it. The only thing so far that we're using is that the domain wall is thin compared to the characteristic scales. That demands a certain kind of potential. I think that is pretty clear. If the scalar potential produces a thin enough wall, I think just at the level of classical general relativity, the arguments are very good. Yeah, so that's the easy part. The hard part is whether or not you have somewhere in the landscape, you know, a quantum string theory that realizes that kind of effective potential. Okay, but no, at the level of just solving classical GR equations, I think the arguments are pretty good. There's one subtlety coming up that is confusing in GR, but I think these so far are sensible. This solution actually is unstable, as you can see, and so you have to work in some neighborhood of this where the instability is not too serious. All right, so again, we've gone from this side by changing initial data at time zero. We've just made the size of this initial bubble of inflating region a little bit bigger each time. So here we're obviously at some sort of, I don't know, cusp, I was going to say, but that's a technical term, some sort of transition point. What happens if we make the bubble 0.01% bigger? Well, here's what happens. First of all, I'll draw the solution on the effective potential. Turns out now what the thing likes to do is to come in from here and go back, where this is r equals infinity. Notice that all of these trajectories start at r equals 0 and end at r equals 0. R equals 0 is the singularity. So those kinds of trajectories start at a singularity and end at a singularity. A trajectory like that starts at r equals infinity and ends at r equals infinity. And I guess I think now I'm going to have to be more creative. On the ADS Schwarzschild black hole, this is r equals infinity. That's an asymptotic boundary, and this is also r equals infinity. This is r equals 0. This is r equals 0. On the De Sitter Penrose diagram, the size of the Penrose diagram doesn't matter. I'm just kind of, I don't know why I'm drawing this littler than that, but don't be confused. Okay, this is r equals infinity. That's the basic difference. You change r equals 0 for r equals infinity. So now we have to start at r equals infinity and end at r equals infinity. That means we have to draw something like this. Notice now, this is the region of De Sitter space we're planning to keep. You've now crossed the De Sitter horizon. This is the region that has all those inflating volumes in it. So we're going to keep some of that infinite inflating volume. The domain wall is going to go up to what you call, well, even I've learned this word, De Sitter scry, okay, this future infinity, where all this infinite inflating volume is, and similarly in the past. And now we have to draw a matching curve in here. We have to start at r equals infinity and end at r equals infinity. This is the only r equals infinity thing available to us. And so there's some curve like that. So we have to join these two pictures together. Well, yeah, this we've defined to be a nice conformal field theory, which means the asymptotic ADS structure is not disturbed. As a solution in general relativity, of course, there's a symmetry. Okay, but the idea here is to keep one of the two boundaries pristine. All right, so now I have to combine these two. Turns into this. This thing in here is De Sitter. This thing here is r equals infinity of De Sitter, which is what we call De Sitter scry. This is all this future volume. This is a piece of ADS. It's this piece. And there's horizons that look like this. And then there's De Sitter horizons that look like, well, let's see. Oh, shit. I'm going to have to change 45 degrees, or else I'll have to redraw the figure. These things are supposed to intersect outside the domain wall. These are light rays, even though they are tired. Like rays. So you have this piece of De Sitter space in this region behind the horizon. It's not only behind the horizon, it's behind two horizons. Okay. Now, it turns out it's reasonably well known to the relativists we talk to. Some of my colleagues are relativists, but that I talk to, I should say, including them. That this kind of vertical line here is bad. You have to specify new initial data on it that wasn't there. You started some time evolution here, and you need to specify new data here to make the problem well posed. If you will, there's what's called a Cauchy horizon that looks like this. It's the region of influence of this thing. And these Cauchy horizons are always virtually unstable. This like the inner horizon, Reissner-Nordström. So what we are told happens, at least some of my colleagues understand this, is that at even a tree level, these ADS asymptotics are destroyed by just classical general relativity, by instabilities. The solution would exist if this domain wall was infinitely thin, but any finite width sets off transients that will cause an instability. And that instability will just cause the singularity to join onto this line. So that seems to be what kind of classical solution can exist in this picture. And the question is, can a boundary ADS CFT actually do this? Okay. I want to emphasize how weird this is. There is an infinite amount of volume up here. There's a new asymptotic region. Can this little gauge theory actually be this clever? Well, we don't know because we don't have a boundary theory to study. What we have to do is just see, is there anything we can find that's inconsistent? Okay, well, fortunately or unfortunately, there are a number of things that are apparently inconsistent. The first is, and this was pointed out by Banks and Busso independently, let me call this monstrosity. What does this look like? There should be some name. We'll call it the star diagram. In the star diagram, the entropy of the De Sitter region is greater than the entropy of the black hole. Well, you can see this. Remember, the coordinate r vanishes on horizons. So along these lines, that's the point, or all along here, is when r equals r De Sitter. And here is where r equals r horizon of the black hole. But r is monotonic, increasing. So this r is greater than that r. The entropy is r to some power. Okay. So the entropy in this De Sitter space is greater than the entropy located on these black hole horizons. Well, this seems paradoxical. If you imagine, I think the basic idea is something called black hole complementarity, that everything behind a black hole horizon can be coded in degrees of freedom outside the horizon. And roughly the degrees of freedom outside the horizon are the ones on the horizon of the black hole. You don't have enough stuff to describe this De Sitter space or all its fluctuations. Well, so we've been puzzling about this for, well, I don't want to tell you how long, but a long time. And our current understanding is that there are three possibilities. One, star is inconsistent. You can't make it in the boundary theory. But there are other possibilities, and naturally we're especially interested in them. Two is that the De Sitter space is created in a special state. So you don't need all the entropy. And three, and this is my current favorite, but it may disappear with the wind, is that in this region right here, where the geometry is approximately ADS Schwarzschild, there's much more entropy than the black hole, because the R is much greater than R of the black hole. But you can get to this point by, remember this analytic continuation I taught you yesterday? Suppose I made a bulk field by smearing some of the boundary fields. Put a bulk field here, take T to I beta over 2, it moves to here. So I should be able to excite some of the degrees of freedom in this region from bulk fields here. Roughly speaking, there's much more entropy out here than there is in the black hole horizon. There's an infinite amount of entropy in anti-de Sitter space. When you go out to the boundary, there are an infinite number of degrees of freedom. They're just not excited. But if you want to excite this region, you can take a field way out here and move it. So it's possible this is the way that you can excite these de Sitter degrees of freedom. But that's a speculation, to say it mildly. All right, 3, I don't know, steel degrees of freedom from large R. Well, if we could get this straight, this would actually be very useful. Suppose this thing did exist. Then we could understand various issues about how inflation uses the degrees of freedom in a well-defined setup. The first thing we could do is actually convince ourselves we have this geometry. You'll remember that yesterday we talked about using geodesic probes to probe geometry behind the horizon. Well, you can imagine doing the same thing here. I guess I'm going to have to redraw the diagram. There's a domain wall here. If you imagine you had a couple of correlators on this boundary, it turns out that light rays bounce off de Sitter scry, just the way they bounce off the black hole singularity. So in fact, there are geodesics that look like that, and there's, of course, you could imagine more elaborate things. And so in computing this correlator, the dominant thing is some complexified geodesic like this, but there are subleading geodesics like this that would be poles on the second sheet, or maybe the kinds of things that Hong has talked about, that would indicate to you that you really have this region of de Sitter space behind these horizons. So there would probably be ways to diagnose if you could understand this boundary theory if you had this or not. That's a big hope, because it's not clear we're going to ever have one of these boundary theories. We also could do interesting things, and here we don't know. We could move R in from infinity. We could put a cutoff in our boundary conformal field theory. So we had only a finite number of degrees of freedom. And ask, does that influence what happens to this infinite amount of space up at de Sitter scry? If it dramatically influenced what happened here, it might indicate that de Sitter scry was made of really independent degrees of freedom. If it doesn't influence things much, it might indicate that all these pieces of volume are basically described by the de Sitter entropy in this holographic way, and that there's not a big effect. For a while, we thought there was a big effect, but that has gone away. And so we don't really know the answer to this question. But this is something you could begin to probe. Of course, another very interesting question is how you would exit from inflation. Remember, we talked about all these bubbles. If this theory has all these different metastable states and stable states, eventually this region is going to stop inflating and bubbles will form. There's a question about, can we say anything about what happens in that case? And I don't really know how to do that. But again, it might be relevant when you decrease the number of degrees of freedom here to see what is able to come out. For instance, if you imagine that you could make a transition to flat space has infinite entropy. And it's not clear where you get all the degrees of freedom to make flat space if this region is cut off. As an aside, I can say that if you made a transition from this inflating patch back down to an ADS situation, or let's say there's even another ADS situation that's even lower down, you don't make a new ADS space. You might think you do. But what happens when you make a transition from here to here is you start an anti-de Sitter space initial data problem, which almost always evolves into a big crunch. So these droplets that drop into anti-de Sitter space are typically going to form black holes hidden behind horizons. And so what the dynamics corresponding to all these different anti-de Sitter minima is going to correspond to different flavors of black holes with little different kinds of asymptotic tails on them telling you which minima you're dropping into. The really interesting and dangerous situation is the one corresponding to flat space, where when you drop into it, you start rapidly making infinite amounts of area and very large amounts of entropy. And that's, of course, the fact that we live in virtual flat space makes that an especially interesting possibility. But that's the one that is most interesting and hardest to control. Well, all right, so the final point I want to make, though, is that this confusing issue of having more entropy in the de Sitter space than in the black hole is not necessary. It would, of course, be much easier if we could just use black hole degrees of freedom to describe here. And there are certain initial data that allow one to do that. And so let me just show you how that works. So on the effective potential, here's R equals 0, R equals infinity. We now just consider a solution that looks like that, that shoots over the barrier. I think I need my colored chalk. So again, let me draw the de Sitter space and the anti-de Sitter space. Here's the de Sitter space. And here is the anti-de Sitter, and here's the black hole. We have to run from R equals 0 to R equals infinity. This is R equals 0. Here's R equals infinity. So we have to run something like this. And here is R equals 0. And here is R equals infinity. And here's R equals 0. And the right thing is to start in this past singularity and go out to infinity. So now we need to piece these two spaces together. And this is impossible to draw, but I'll give you the best version that I can. Okay, so here's a black hole. Here's de Sitter scry. Now we have to bend this around, this R equals 0 line, to put it all in one diagram. That's a singularity. And here's a domain wall. This is de Sitter space. This is ADS. And here's some horizons. There's a horizon. There's a horizon. And then here's a horizon. And because this is R de Sitter, where this horizon vanishes, and this is R black hole, where this horizon vanishes, it turns out R is decreasing to 0 here, so R black hole is bigger than R de Sitter. So the entropy here of the black hole is greater than the entropy of the sitter space. And so it's a reasonable guess that the degrees of freedom on the black hole horizon could describe what's happening in this de Sitter patch. It's nice to know this thing exists. Boy, that is a bad diagram. But until we understand these diagrams where the entropy inequality goes the other way and how it's resolved, I don't think we can have much confidence about the validity of this description either. Okay, so again, I think I've said most of what I wanted to say. Embedding inflation into a well-defined theory of quantum gravity will hopefully teach us a lot. I think the best that can be said about this is a first step. And we still need to know whether or not it works. Again, I guess just to return to this point from last time, what we really need is this local bulk description of quantum gravity that would let us in some unified way talk about anti-de Sitter space, de Sitter space, and all these phenomena that don't have natural asymptotics. And then we would be able to make real progress in this problem. So maybe that would be a good homework problem to work on. All right, thank you. Yeah. We shouldn't. We're from here, you mean? This thing here or this here? It's not really a boundary. It's just it's an origin of polar coordinates. So it's not a real boundary. Anything else? Okay.
Okay, so I'd like to present Steve with our cup. Thank you.